welcome to another edition of Newsroom Insider. I'm John Wells. The title of this podcast is Murder Most Foul, The Strange Case of Dr. Douglas McRobbie. Or, if you like, the alternative title could well be McRobbie's Ghost, but more on haunted houses in a bit. I've written about Hamilton cold cases before. A couple of the stories were about unsolved homicides that go back a few years, and one of them was from 1974. But the McRobbie case goes back much further than that, 100 years to August 19th, 1917. I've been asked over the years where I get my ideas for crime stories, and the answer is, it's a mix. Sometimes I'll search our database and come up with a case to revisit. Sometimes an editor will suggest it, or a reader, or even a police officer. A few months ago, a man named Aaron Blake contacted my editor. He had a story idea, the 100th anniversary of the unsolved death of Dr. Douglas McRobbie, who was found on a hot summer night in a pool of blood in the offices of Crescent Oil on Cannon Street at Bay. Aaron, who works for Crescent Oil, and in the building that is still there today, said he had done some research on the story at the library. My editor handed the ball off to me, and I met with Aaron, and I learned that he had researched a lot, going through thousands of words of coverage of the case back in the day when Hamilton had three daily newspapers, including The Spectator. What emerged from my meeting with Aaron is a feature story that I could not have done without him, in part because it was his idea, and in fact, he is the only person I've ever come across who knew anything about the McRobbie case. Even Hamilton police files in the case have long been destroyed. And then certainly his enthusiasm for the topic was infectious. At times, I felt like I was following in his footsteps. I went to the library and read through all the stories myself that he had read through. Aaron visited with a distant relative of McRobbie's, and then I interviewed the man as well, on the phone. To write the story, I used Aaron Blake as my news hook. He is the present-day character who delves into the past to unearth the cold case story, and unearth it quite literally in Hamilton Cemetery, where he found McRobbie's stone, grown over entirely with grass. And then I mined details of the case from newspapers back then, long-dead crime reporters whose words, at least on this case, had not been read by anyone in many decades, I would think. All of which gave me pause when thinking about what, if anything, of mine will be read in 100 years. I recorded a video about the case with Aaron, and you can find that on the Spec's website, embedded in the story. And I also did a podcast interview with him. We met in the building where it all happened 100 years ago, and where some say McRobbie's restless ghost can still be felt. Aaron, thanks for being with me today.
My pleasure.
We're here in the Crescent Oil building, and you have in front of you newspaper clippings from back then, August 1917, and the media coverage of the story.
Yeah.
You were saying some of the headlines are quite colorful.
Oh yeah,
back in the day.
Very descriptive. Some of the headlines even have like a little magnifying glass or like a police head or a smoking gun.
Right.
Just to add a little charm to the story. Like this one, for example, little light thrown upon the McRobbie tragedy. And one of the witnesses they're talking about is proving to be unsatisfactory. And they talk about contradictions in the testimony. It's very detailed.
Yeah.
And it really grabs your attention.
And of course, there were three daily newspapers at the time.
Yeah, Hamilton Herald, Times, and Spectator, I believe.
And most importantly, The Spectator.
The Spectator, absolutely. I found The Spectator articles to be the most detailed and thorough.
Well, there you go. That's why we survived, I guess.
Yeah.
So now talk to me about the first time you heard that someone had died in this building.
Yeah.
Because that's the seed of where this all came from for you.
Well, I'm quite inquisitive by nature. Mm-hmm. I like learning about different things, especially areas of my life where I'm like heavily involved. So my wife's family business is Crescent Oil. She's fourth generation, and we have been together for almost 10 years. And I used to come visit her when we were dating. And I asked her some questions about the building. It is a very old building. I believe this building was was built in the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. And I inquired about, you know, who had resided here before, when did they get the business? And I was told that her great-grandfather bought it in 1928. And over the course of that conversation, my father-in-law mentioned to me that, you know, there's a lot of history with this building. There's been, you know, four generations of humans who've been involved with the business. But also, before their time, there was some infamy in the building, as a man had died upstairs under suspicious circumstances. And I asked him to, you know, go into detail a little bit more over what happened, and he wasn't sure. That's just the extent of the story that had been passed down, because, mind you, we're five generations of Crescent Oil ownership from when this incident happened, and the details just, they weren't shared. So I decided I was going to dig a little deeper and think, you know, I thought to myself, well, where can I get more information? So I went to the library at Jackson Square, and I was really surprised. I just went those old index cards and I pulled out Crescent Oil, mm-hmm. and there was literally pages and pages of content based on this case, the Dr. McRobbie case.
And when you went to the library, did you have the McRobbie name? You
didn't. I didn't know who he was. All I knew was someone had died in Crescent Oil. Like, you know, even the circumstances of what happened, like, nobody knew. Mm-hmm. And Dr. McRobbie's name popped up under the Crescent Oil Index. Like, they were connected.
Right.
And then I went to the Dr. McRobbie section, index card, I should say, and that had the information on the articles, too. So the people at the library were extremely helpful. They gave me the original copies to review, and I made photocopies for myself and began reviewing the content and was instantly captivated in the mystery of what happened then.
And for reasons that will become clear as we chat about this, his name was not included in their archive of historical homicides.
That's correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And we'll explain why that is in a minute. And also the Crescent Oil building you were mentioning, the building's at on Cannon near Bay.
Yeah.
And it's also hard against Railway Street.
Yeah.
Which is where Johnny Papalia was gunned down 20 years ago this past spring.
Yeah, actually, my brother-in-law, Dash, was working at Crescent the day it happened. He wasn't here when it happened, but mm-hmm. earlier that morning. And I think he was a little shook up over the whole thing.
So it's an interesting part of town. And right across the street where Sir Johnny MacDonald High School is, I guess, used to be the Royal Oak Tavern.
Royal Oak Hotel.
Hotel, which... Yeah. And Dr. McRobbie knew the tavern well.
Let's say he frequented the establishment on a regular basis.
On a regular basis. Because this is the time, you know, in the story, I write about this, and this is all over, you know, this comes out of the stories, that this time, 1917, alcohol, at least hard liquor, is a social taboo.
Correct.
But everyone's drinking.
Yeah.
And there's the Temperance Act. It's against the law to buy hard liquor, except from doctors. So you have this interest, and the whole bootlegging industry has begun. Mm-hmm. Hamilton's a hotbed for that, so it's an interesting time.
Definitely.
So you research at the library.
Yeah.
And you dive into this case.
Yes.
And I'm assuming as you're reading through the articles, you don't know how it ends.
No.
Right.
That's correct.
So talk a bit about the case. So McRobbie is found dead in a pool of blood.
Yes.
After a night of drinking with three men.
Yeah.
Upstairs in this building.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, so it was on a Sunday too. Keep in mind that this is the holy day, even more so probably in 1917 than now.
Sure.
And all indications were that he was with these men the previous night. The articles don't touch on exactly what happened on the Saturday. They're more focused on the Sunday, which was the unfortunate day that Dr. McRobbie was killed. Mm-hmm. Basically, throughout the day, he... was seen in Hamilton drinking with three of the men who are named Walter Scott. He was a prominent architect. J.J. McAlfie, who was a real estate agent. And Harry Smith, who was the previous owner of Crescent Oil before my wife's great-grandfather bought it off his estate when he passed away in 1928. Mm-hmm. The timeline can get a little confusing. Anyone who reviews these articles will see that there's a lot of contradictory evidence over the state of the men, where they were at certain points in time throughout that day. But I think it's unanimously agreed by all parties that Dr. McRobbie was in the vicinity of Crescent Oil between 9 p.m. and 1 a.m. when his body was discovered by the coroner and local police.
And the coroner and the police show up about an hour and a half after he died, more or less. Is that right?
That's the estimate. And this is where the water is extremely murky. And you need to kind of draw details together based on what I've done is focused on the forensic evidence and the behavior of the men during the day, and more particularly after Dr. McRobbie was found.
Right. Because I, you know, from the timeline, in terms of when he's wounded and bleeding to death,
yeah,
two of the three men leave the building.
Yes.
Right? And go home.
That's correct.
And go to bed.
That's what is alleged.
And the third man, he's found out in the yard, yep, outside Crescent Oil.
Yeah, right? Missing his collar and wearing one shoe.
Yeah,
completely intoxicated. They actually use the words paralyzed drunk. Not just merely intoxicated, but paralyzed drunk on the night of the tragedy.
Wow. And now, and initially, you have the coroner, you have another couple of doctors who do the autopsy.
Yeah.
And initially, the story seems to come out of this that it well could have been an accident.
That was the initial narrative. I think everyone was shocked, and initially people couldn't believe that anything else other than an accident could have happened to the good doctor, as he's referred to often in the article.
And he'd been bleeding from the head. I don't think we mentioned that. The wound, when they find him, is a head wound.
He had two severe skull fractures,
right,
on the left side of his head, as well as a fractured hand. That was the description of the injuries in the article.
Right.
And he was found, in a pool of his own blood.
And blood on the walls?
Blood on the walls, blood on a buggy, and all these, historical oil company supplies, bars and pulleys, all the stuff they used to run the business back then.
Right.
They referred to the room he was found in as the death chamber.
That's right.
In the story later on when they got to the trial. And I can just imagine, like, we never saw any pictures, and you and I both looked into finding pictures and information from the police at that point in time from 1917, but all records have been, you know, gotten rid of by this point, so there's nothing, unfortunately. But I just visualize a scene that's a bloodbath, for lack of a better term.
Right. And he's lying beside these iron bars.
Yeah.
To describe them. Mm-hmm. So the initial sort of thought is maybe he fell and hit his head on the bars.
Yes.
And the night watchman, whose name is Asselstein?
Herbert Asselstein.
Asselstein. So
how you pronounce
his name. He's the one who sort of finds the body, or he's the initial contact. At least there are some other men involved.
Allegedly,
it's kind of complicated. But
yeah,
so this becomes the initial, as you say, narrative that perhaps it was an accident. And I think even the night watchman says to the police, they said, "Oh, how did you react?" And he said, "Oh, I thought this poor man has had an accident."
Yeah,
is perhaps just maybe spinning.
I would say
the story.
I would say definitely there was a lot of spinning going on by Herbert Asselstein and some of the other Crescent Oil staff who, you know, for the record, were called before the police and the doctors to come to the scene that night.
Exactly. This body's found before the doctors, or it was the doctors who called the police. Before the doctors are even called, these officials with the company are called. So,
correct.
So people are up to something, it seems.
Yeah.
But now, you know, ultimately, and from my reading of it, you know, certainly the lead detective, Harry Sayre,
yeah,
and the police, you know, he's sort of a hero of sorts of the story. He's working diligently on this. But then I'm also struck by the doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, they keep digging in this in terms of trying to figure out how he died.
Yes.
Digging literally.
Digging literally. So what happened was, and they didn't even... I believe they didn't want this to be announced publicly, but I think 4 or 5 days after Dr. McRobbie was buried, they exhumed his body to do a secondary examination of his head wounds. And this was met with, I would say, giant surprise and shock from the community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like something that would happen out of a movie. I've never heard of anyone getting exhumed before other than this.
Right.
And one of the, I believe it was the coroner or the doctor was saying, you know, I never gave a written order for this. It wasn't on record. We just wanted to do it and be thorough because they had kind of reviewed the evidence and the information and they started leading towards foul play and a homicide, right, opposed to an accident, just based on the severity of the wounds and how they were structured on the back of his head.
And maybe also, I mean, I've just been speculating as well, you know, the evidence comes out from a couple of women who said they heard screams, yeah, and so on. So maybe there's this pool of evidence gathering that there had been, there was more than a fall.
Where there's smoke, there's fire, yeah, they say.
Yeah.
And I think everybody initially probably didn't want to believe that there was foul play at the Crescent Oil building. I mean, as mentioned, these were four of the most affluent professionals in the city of Hamilton at this point in time. And it was a surprise.
Yeah. So now we'll get to the punchline here in a moment. But so here you are, you found out that someone had died in the building, you're researching, yeah, it. This was 3 years ago, you said?
I would say around 3 or 4 years ago.
That you started reading up on this, researching, yeah, the case. So why? What was it that prompted you to go so deep into this to this day?
Well, my natural curiosity. Mm-hmm. I really was intrigued what happened to the doctor, not just because of my personal connection to Crescent Oil, because I'm in this building all the time, or that my family comes here daily, but I just really wanted to learn what happened, mm-hmm, and try to like put the pieces together myself.
Right.
Like you could say my inner sleuth came out. I was not too pleased with what I found at the end, but we're gonna discuss that.
Let's branch to that now. Okay. So you're going through the articles,
yeah,
in the library, and there are tons of articles in, yeah, terms of the build up to the inquest, mm-hmm, is held, which determines that there'll be charges laid against the three men
for manslaughter. Yeah,
for manslaughter, and also a fourth man, the night watchman.
Yeah,
and so it goes to trial.
Yeah,
for manslaughter for these four men.
Yeah,
and certainly by my reading the articles, and you know, it's the case is looking pretty strong, is it not?
I would say, I mean, it's strong in the sense that, and even the newspapers are very careful not to finger point any of these men in particular. They, mm-hmm, they did a very good job presenting the information, but you have a man with blunt force trauma to the back of his head. You've got three men who, on record, you know, people unanimously agree are with him.
Yes. And leave the scene.
And two of the three leave the scene.
Yeah.
He couldn't have hit himself in the back of the head to get these marks. I think they did have a strong case. They also, they had something that they felt was a murder weapon too, this molding. However, mm-hmm, I believe the original murder weapon was taken from Crescent Oil that night. And this other piece of molding had blood spatter on it from when Dr. McRobbie was being attacked.
Right.
And the police kind of went with that. It's not to say that this molding, this type of molding didn't kill him, but this particular molding that they had in, as it had for evidence, they actually tried to get fingerprints off it and they weren't able to.
Mm-hmm.
Again, and you know, just that comment right there, that really illustrates the lack of forensic technology in 1917.
Yeah.
And I'm confident they would have been able to extract something in 2017.
Right.
In fact, on forensic evidence alone in 2017, they probably could have figured out who did this.
Right. Yeah. And certainly, you know, I found interesting, you know, compared to today, they're in terms of the crime scene analysis. You know,
yeah.
They bring in a local architect to do blueprints.
Yeah.
Of the scene. The blood expert is a local physician.
Yeah.
I believe, and so they're, you know, they're doing what they can with what they have.
Yeah.
At the time, but. It certainly isn't. It's not CSI.
It was strange because, like, you know, such credence is put on medical experts when it comes to solving cases now with DNA and forensic, mm-hmm, and blood spatter, and these guys were thorough. Like once they moved away from the narrative of this being an accident, they gave lots of examples of why they thought it wasn't. And to me, I think that evidence in modern day would hold a lot of weight in a criminal proceeding.
There's even a bit of detail I found morbidly fascinating, where one of the doctors goes to a slaughterhouse to see how when cows are wounded,
yeah,
how they
drop, well, I think,
yeah, how they fall,
yeah,
and in terms of the hemorrhaging and all that kind of stuff, which
yeah,
But you know, they're juggling. They're doing all they can.
You say it well. They were doing the best with what they had in 1917.
Right. So it goes to the trial.
Yeah.
And what do you find out as you read through what happens there? Well,
first, I want to say the criminal justice system in this case, and I think back then in general, moved a lot quickly.
Absolutely.
This incident happened on August 19th.
Yeah.
The trial happened November 14th and 15th.
The same year.
Of the same year.
Yeah,
so everything was wrapped up in under 3 months. I believe that all three men were not given bail during this time. I think they were in jail consistently.
They were helpless, right?
I believe so.
Barton Street Jail.
Yeah, Barton Street Jail for the 3 months or nearly 3 months. And the trial goes for 2 days. It goes day and night. And lots of evidence is presented. There's lots of witnesses who talk about seeing the men that day and what their state was.
And there's a jury.
There's a jury.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Judge and jury.
Lots of contradictory testimony over what everybody's doing.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately what happens is on the second day, the judge in the matter pulls the case away from the jury, overrules, and issues a not guilty verdict.
This is Judge Latchford?
Judge Latchford,
yeah.
I believe, or Langford. Langford, Judge Langford,
yeah.
I think. Or is it Latchford? I think it's Langford.
Yeah.
And I don't have the quote in front of me, but he gets the jury to agree. I guess there was some clause, and I wish I knew more about this, that a judge has the ability to pull cases away from the jury if he feels there's no reasonable chance of conviction.
Mm-hmm.
So he did that, and he made a comment along the lines that he addressed the jury and said there was no evidence to suggest that Dr. McRobbie was killed by one or all of these men in a criminal manner if a crime did in fact happen.
Right.
At that point, he addressed Herbert Asselstein first and got him out of there. I Herbert Asselstein was charged. It was a power play move to get him to talk more. I truly believe that.
The Night Watchman.
Yeah, the Night Watchman. He was these records seem to make him sound like a bit of a simpleton.
Yes.
And then he gets the three men to stand up, and basically what he does is he lectures them like a father lecturing his teenage son who had drank too much, telling them that they've got great reputations in the public and alcohol has caused them to do this and they couldn't resist the sweet intoxication of liquor. And he advised them that they, if they knew better, they should never drink again. And then they were discharged.
Yeah.
And then the men were shaking hands with other prominent professionals in the area, I assume, and the story ends. And I looked at other papers shortly thereafter, and the coverage of the story went dark after that. That was nothing. There was nothing. It ended. So
yeah.
I was really surprised, and I was kind of like face-palming myself. Like, are you kidding me? Like, they believe the doctor died accidentally despite all this heavy forensic evidence,
yeah,
and severity of his skull fracture. And I mean, in my opinion, you know, one or two of the men or all three got away with murder.
And you have the doctors at the trial,
yeah,
talking about the wounds and you know, the sort of asked, you know, could it have been accidentally, could he fall? And they said, well, you know, no, unless he fell once and stood up and like dove on his head again onto the bars.
Yeah.
But the judge, you know, the fact that line, like you said, the judge says, you know, if in fact a crime did occur,
yeah,
to me is outrageous.
I agree.
Because it was blunt force trauma.
Absolutely.
He was bludgeoned to death. And I believe it said, you know, in terms of the legal threshold, they just had to have found that one of them was responsible and they all would be responsible for manslaughter because they were all together.
I think so. Like, I would actually love to talk to a lawyer who maybe has a little more familiarity with,
yeah,
law in 1917, but I think that sounds appropriate.
Yeah, but he said that, you know, if a crime had even occurred to, as, you know, so the headline said, you know, he takes away from the jury. That was the phraseology, I think.
Yep.
So you're doing your research. You come to that sort of the cruel kind of punchline,
yeah,
to that is with all this buildup. I mean, just thousands of words written in three new newspapers. The McRobbie tragedy. It's the, you know, people hadn't, you know, it captured the city's imagination. People packing the inquest room
and
all that kind of stuff.
And that's interesting. Like, just going back to that point, like this story captivated the city of Hamilton in an immense way. The articles speak of dozens, even hundreds of people being lined up outside the police station or the courtroom, like with their ear against the door, like, what happened? What's the update?
Yeah.
Everybody was fascinated. Everybody wanted to know the truth. And this was the truth that was determined in a court of law, which, you know, in my opinion, was bogus.
Yeah.
And I was upset because I felt this was a grave injustice to the doctor
mm-hmm.
and his family. Although, I did have one thought, and we'll never know for sure, but maybe, I think this is a stretch, but maybe the doctor's family maybe wanted it to be an accident. Maybe it was easier for them to settle on, to accept
right.
that this was just a terrible, tragic accident opposed to mm-hmm. him getting killed while drinking illegally
right.
in a Crescent Oil building on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I'm speculating. Whatever the case was, the judge got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say definitely two of these three men got away with murder. And I feel that some of the other employees of Crescent Oil and possibly the proprietor's wife, Harry Smith, at the time, they were accomplices in covering up what happened here.
You know, you mentioned how in the media coverage, after all this coverage, it goes silent. And,
yeah.
And I looked in the days and the Spectator that followed that
yeah.
verdict, and there's nothing.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, today, if there's an outrageous verdict of some kind, I mean, the paper would be going over it, you know, over and over in terms of analyzing it, criticism,
yeah, appeal court,
all that stuff. But back then, I mean, I guess it's that sense of, you know, the authority of the judge, you know, well, and that's it, you know.
Yeah.
So I find that quite, the silence pretty eerie. That's what
it is. It is eerie, definitely.
So now you just recently, just last Easter Sunday,
mm-hmm.
You've been doing all this research, you read up on all the case, you want to find his gravestone.
Yeah.
Did it just occur to you sort of that you want to recently that, or you always thought, you know, at some point I'm going to want to try to find his stone?
I thought it might be a good idea. I had noted in one of the articles they mentioned that he was buried at York Cemetery just down the road here.
Hamilton Cemetery. Yeah.
And I went to the main office there and I asked if they could give me the coordinates, but I didn't say give me the exact coordinates. I said give me a range because it was Easter Sunday, so I kind of thought we'd incorporate it like an Easter egg hunt, like
yeah.
trying to find the grave.
Right.
So my mom, my sister-in-law, my two-year-old, and my wife, who was 7 months pregnant at the time, although she basically waited in the car. She didn't really walk. She couldn't really walk too much. We looked for the grave for hours in the area where they said it was.
Hours?
Yeah. I'd say probably 2.5 to 3 hours.
Yeah.
And then it was starting to rain a little bit, so we gave up and went and had a Easter Sunday dinner. And then I went back and I said, can you give me the exact coordinates? They gave me the exact coordinates. I went back again. And I found the plot, but there was no grave. So this led me to believe there was one of two things that had happened. Either A, the stone had been removed, so it was upright and someone had taken it away and it hadn't been replaced, or just damaged and broken. Although there's stones there that are well over 100 years old, they're still standing. Or it was, what are they called? A ground stone?
Mm-hmm.
One that just lies flat ground stone. Yeah. And I went back to the cemetery and they... for lack of a better term, exhumed that little area again
right.
and found that Dr. McRobbie's stone was in fact there, covered by earth and dirt all this time. And like I've told other people when I talked about this, like to me that is the epitome of being forgotten, is your grave is completely covered by dirt. There was also two stones there of his mom and dad, although they're not buried there, they're just like memorial stones.
Right.
So I felt good that it was the gravestone was uncovered. Simple stone, which in the other area, there's lots of big, more vibrant stones. And I thought maybe an affluent man like Dr. McRobbie may have had a bigger stone.
Right.
But for whatever reason, he had one of the most simple stones in the whole graveyard.
And on the stone it said?
It said, it gave his name, his medical accreditation, and then at the end it said Daddy.
Daddy, because he had two young
daughters. I believe they were 2 and 5
right.
at the time when they died. And actually... I did a little bit of research into his family lineage on Ancestry, and it looks like one of the daughters never wed and had children, but the other one wed and had 3 kids. So you never know. Maybe at some point I'll be able to connect with some of Dr. McRobbie's distant great grandchildren or anywhere in between that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I guess so. He could have grandchildren alive if they would have been born in the play 1930s or 40s. That's reasonable,
mm-hmm.
even 50s. So it's reasonable to think that he has grandkids and anything after that still in the Ontario area somewhere.
So you felt, you know, after, you know, the research, finding out what happened in the case, which is so unsatisfying.
Yeah.
But you, as you say, you did uncover the stone. And now, you know, you contacted the Spectator. This was your idea for the story.
Yeah, I contacted Cheryl.
Yeah, my editor Cheryl, yeah.
Cheryl around Christmas time, and I just kind of, I gave her a quick rundown on what I knew. I talked about, you know, the articles, and it was, in my mind, a true crime story that happened 100 years ago that was quite sensational. She was interested, and she said we'd be in touch in the new year, and then I believe you and I started talking around January or February. And just had brief conversations, and as we've got closer to the date, we've met more and talked more about the case.
And so now, you know, this case that had been buried and
literally
for quite some
nice
time.
Nice double entendre there.
Yeah, so it's out there, so that must give you a sense of satisfaction, at least, that it's been brought out.
I want the story to be told. I think it's part of the city's history, and I think it's important that people know what happened, and also how the criminal justice system worked back then. What the behavior of some people were like, just how life was, culture in Hamilton in 1917. I think it's important, and I really felt reviewing these articles that it kind of put me back in 1917. I really got a feel for what the vibe of the city was then,
mm-hmm.
and it was interesting. It really helped me appreciate where the city was and where we are now, and where we're going still.
And ending on a final note, you know, we're in the building, and. You know, if the doctor has been resting restlessly for these 100 years,
mm-hmm.
Some believe that there are signs of that still in the building.
Yeah, there's been reports for decades that the building is haunted, mm-hmm. quote unquote. There's sounds coming upstairs and alarms going off without no real reason, doors slamming, and just. More than any of those points, just a feeling of unrest. Like people, when they go upstairs to the upstairs part of Crescent Oil, which is now Fuels, it's a secondary business, Crescent Oil's sister company. People get uncomfortable going upstairs. They feel a sense of something off or something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily believe, so to speak, but there's definitely been many cases over the years of people feeling. I guess you could say a supernatural vibe,
mm-hmm.
in the Crescent Oil building, and particularly the office upstairs where Dr. McRobbie was killed and his body was found.
Well, it'll be interesting to see after the story appears, and perhaps some sense of the injustice that has been done to him is out there, that maybe the building will be quieter.
Maybe it will be quieter. Maybe the doctor can finally rest. I'm just really happy that his story is getting told. And I really hope and I feel that readers of the story will enjoy it, be captivated, and put on their inner sleuth caps,
yeah.
and just appreciate and enjoy the story as much as I have.
Well, Aaron, thanks. Thank you for bringing the story to our attention, and
yeah.
thanks for all your help with it.
No problem. I appreciate it. It's been my pleasure.